The next film we subjected ourselves to, again, because we've all seen this at least once before.
It was my first time. It was my first time.
Caro has never seen Hackers, yeah. Which is
I
also
hadn't
strangely.
Seen it either.
Oh!
Whoa, really? Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 41. I'm your host, Anita Sarkeesian, and I'm joined by my very own Crash and Burn, Ebony Astor, and Carolyn Pettit.
Hey!
What's up?
This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, we're the feminist killjoys coming for your media, depending on your perspective. Today's show is a 90s cyberpunk double feature with Strange Days and Hackers. And as always, we'll finish the show by all sharing a little something in What's Your Freakout? Now on with the show. What's up, y'all?
Hey.
Hey.
So we're talking about a few tech-themed films today. Anita, you played some D&D this weekend,
yeah.
Right? But your D&D campaign is like tech oriented, right? Would you call it cyberpunk or?
Oh yeah,
okay.
It's like a hard sci. It's a hard sci-fi
okay.
world that is using the D&D 5 rules.
Rules, okay.
There's a lot of like I think I've mentioned before, my druid character can instead of like the speaking with plants and speaking with animals spells
yeah.
go to technology.
Right.
Fun thing is I have. I convinced my shipmates that the little bots around the ship are actually DRDs from Farscape, if anyone is a Farscape fan. And so now they're just like, it's in the canon as DRDs, which makes me so happy.
Okay, I don't know what a DRD is.
They're like basically Roombas
in
the Farscape universe,
okay.
But like they like clean and repair and do shit on the ship.
Cool,
and
I want one of those.
They're so cute.
Yeah.
I was at Dragon Con one year and I saw folks like, cosplaying as DRDs,
wow.
And I ran up two flights of stairs, or no, escalators. I ran up escalators to find them because I was like, that's the most amazing cosplay.
Yeah.
So what up, Farscape fans? Anyways, that D&D was loads of fun. I'm getting sort of sucked in. I bought some dice.
Dude, photo of your new dice that I saw.
They're great.
They're so beautiful.
But so now I need to buy the tray that you shoot the dice in because they're so heavy they're going to damage any table that I roll them on.
Yeah.
And now I want a mini of my character. It's a whole thing.
Yeah.
I'm getting sucked into this fucking bullshit world.
I feel you. I mean, there's something about like when I see those pictures of dice, it's like, oh man, I want to get back into D&D or something myself. Like I want to, you know, there's just the aesthetics of it all, like the tactility of it, you know, is just something that obviously a video game can't produce.
Yeah.
And there's just something special about
it. All right, y'all, let's get into some entertainment news. What do we got on the docket, Carol?
So, first of all, we have a story about Serena Williams, the greatest tennis player in, you know, the history of the world, like at least arguably, like that is a totally fair
statement. I'd say
statement.
The universe. The expanding universe.
Okay, all right. I mean, wow. You know, Gorblok's Ingleblorb on the planet Neutron is pretty good too, but,
they ain't got nothing on Serena.
Fair. So at the French Open, has banned Serena or ruled that Serena Williams may not wear this Nike-designed, Wakanda-themed sort of cat suit that was designed for Serena Williams specifically to reduce the danger of blood clots, which are a medical issue that Serena Williams has had to contend with. And it's just, like, mind-blowing. I mean, or not mind-blowing at all that Serena Williams gets, like, singled out for this. Billie Jean King, the great tennis champion, tweeted, the policing of women's bodies must end. The quote-unquote respect, because they said, well, you know, she needs to respect the game. Like, whatever that means. Like, she needs to wear, like, a fucking skirt, you know, a little short skirt on the court or whatever. So Billie Jean King said that the quote, respect that's needed is for the exceptional talent Serena Williams brings to the game. Criticizing what she wears to work is where the true disrespect lies. And Serena Williams, in typical, like, I mean, she just goes so far above and beyond what anyone should be expected to do in terms of, like, rising above the issues and not, like, You know, she said something like, you know, it's fine, guys. Everything's fine. When it comes to fashion, you don't want to be a repeat offender. She kind of made like a little joke about it at a press conference. But obviously, like, there are real issues of racism and sexism, like, at play here. So it's, yeah, it's messed up.
It's super bullshit.
Yeah. This next story's kind of grim and tragic, but it would be conspicuous and unfortunate if we didn't touch on it at least. On Sunday at a location called the GLHF, a game bar in Jacksonville, Florida, there was a shooting that occurred at a Madden football video game tournament, in which two players were killed. Their names are Taylor Robertson, who was known online by his handle Spot Me Please or Spot Me, and Eli True Clayton, also known as True Boy. The shooter was David Katz, was a competitor in the tournament who was eliminated. And it's sort of believed or speculated that the shooting was a kind of reaction to him being eliminated from the tournament. And obviously, this opens up so many issues in a much larger discussion than we have the time or ability to get into right now. But, you know, people often talk about the links between, you know, video games and violence as some kind of causality thing. But when they do that, they're talking about games like, you know, if they're trying to kind of create a sort of hysteria around it, they use games like Doom or, you know, like games in which with a lot of violent shooting and gory, like violence of that nature. And of course, American football is a brutal sport that leads to severe injuries and the degradation of men's bodies. But it's also not typically the kind of game that people think of, you know, when they think of violent games and being linked to like actual any link to actual violence. And, you know, it's just, to me, it's just another American gun tragedy that speaks to the need for us to confront both our lack of gun control laws and our severe problems with toxic masculinity run amok, right? Those are the conversations that we keep not wanting to have. Okay, lastly, I want to talk about a tweet that went out. This is going to be related in some ways to the main topic on this episode. So the next big game from CD Projekt Red, makers of the, you know, acclaimed epic open world RPG, The Witcher 3, which Anita loved. Their next game is Cyberpunk 2077, which is an open world as the cyberpunk epic RPG. You know, which takes some inspiration from a tabletop cyberpunk role playing game, and obviously, like, there's so much excitement and interest and enthusiasm about this game, you know. In this past week, a fan tweeted at them in response to like a photo they tweeted. A fan responded like, "We want more guys," which I don't know what that even means. But Cyberpunk 2077's Twitter response was, "Did you just assume their gender?" Which is such a transphobic, you know, meme that is so kind of commonplace in a lot of toxic circles of the internet, right? It's meant to sort of mock their idea of what they think, like, transgender people say, or like how we think or how we behave. It's just another from the same kind of school of like, I identify as an attack helicopter. Like, it exists to sort of mock and dismiss the validity of trans identity. And they were severely called out on it, and they deleted the tweet and they apologized. But the apology they issued was of the sorry to all those offended nature, which is the worst kind of apology, because it suggests that the problem isn't with what we said. The problem is that some people took offense to it. So it lets those who feel like, oh, it was just a harmless joke, or like, you know, LOL, that was funny, you know, fuck the SJWs for raising a stink about it. It lets them feel like, oh, you know, Cyberpunk 2077 is kind of on their side, you know, and just feels like, oh, we had to do this because all these people got offended, not because what we said was fucked up.
Yeah, totally.
And yeah.
Well, and the thing is that this developer is not known for being progressive or like at all supportive of like making progressive media, right? Yeah. Like the Witcher franchise from the beginning has been at the forefront of our trope series, right? Like there's been a lot of like awful representation of women in it, and like they've not, so I'm not surprised, and I'm extremely disappointed that this is still a thing that's happening in games and that developers still like get to be shitty about like identity issues.
And this raised an interesting conversation or debate about what it what cyberpunk really means, because one person got a few thousand retweets by tweeting like the most cyberpunk thing you can do is be kind and respectful to people online, and that's like a nice sentiment.
I get
where they're coming from. They are coming from like the idea that cyberpunk has a political core of being like anti-corporation and like pro individual, and like there is a lot of like landmark cyberpunk stuff that has, I think, that kind of, if you dig into its politics, it has that. But obviously there's plenty of cyberpunk that doesn't as well. And like other people tweeted stuff like, well, no, the most cyberpunk thing you can do is like fly your hover car in the rain or like through the neon lit skies over the corporate arcologies, you know, or whatever. And it's like this debate between like a stat, like we as human beings are so kind of easily seduced by like aesthetics. And to so many people, like cyberpunk is it's rain and gloom and neon and like tech. While to other people, it's like, oh, no, it's about this anti-corporate, like pro-human, like political ideology. And, I think these conversations come up like all the time in all kinds of like science fiction media, because it's so easy for images to kind of glorify and be seductive. Like it's, you know, these similar conversations I think happened with Mad Max, where, you know, to some people, it's this like bold feminist statement. To others, though, it's like what you walk out of that film with is like, whoa, that was badass. That blasted future Earth. Like, oh, you know, I'd love to like ride a fucking car with Dune Buggy with like machine guns strapped to it across
the
desert.
And the dude with the guitar.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that a lot of critics and a lot of people, when debating or discussing this stuff, want to dismiss how easily seduced we are by like beautiful aesthetics and how much those can like override any like underlying political, you know, meaning that some may say a work has.
Yeah, I mean, I saw the tweet from them, but I haven't seen the debate unfurl. And
yeah.
Like, you can't remove the aesthetics from cyberpunk. That's just an ingrained part of how we define the genre of it. But that doesn't mean it can't change, and it doesn't mean that's always there. And, you know, it is really disappointing when people do try to strip politics out of, cyberpunk is such a huge genre too that it's a weird thing to be like. I mean, there are parameters around it, but it's a weird thing to be like. From your description, this debate sounds stupid. Is what I'm trying to say. But it's frustrating when people try to strip the politics out of things that are very clearly there because it doesn't gel with them. When you might not like it, but it's there.
Yeah.
Right. Like that is the anti-establishment piece of this is so huge, and it always has been, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That would be a great segue into our next segment, although
Anita's gonna ruin it.
I sure am. I would like to take a moment to let our listeners know that they can help us keep making Feminist Frequency and bringing it to their airwaves, their personal devices, their items,
the implants, the cyber implants that allow them to get the podcast
jacked in.
Yeah,
they jack in the podcast
exactly.
to their brains.
Yeah,
exactly. They can continue having that amazing technology while there are neon lights behind them by backing us at d.rip/femfreak. And if you do that, you get some special perks like a bonus segment, which we're going to have. every week, including this week, and some other fun perks. So please help us out. Anything you want to chip in is useful to us.
Yeah.
It really, to make this.
It helps. Really helps us.
It's
keep
weird.
Doing the show.
It's weird how money does that, isn't it?
Yeah.
That whole plug sounded like that bit from 30 Rock with Steve Buscemi in the school when he goes undercover and is like, "How are you doing, fellow kids?"
I didn't watch that show, but that sounds really funny. Anyways, check us out, d.rip/femfreak. Now it's time for the main segment. this week, we are gifting you with a double feature from the 90s.
It's not a gift. It's not a gift. It is a flaming paper bag of dog shit that we left on your doorstep.
Wow, big words,
the
Ebony.
Movies might be that or not.
But we are the gift.
Yeah.
God, Ebony.
Yeah.
All right, let me set us up. We're going to talk about Strange Days, which is a 1995 film directed by Catherine Bigelow and written by James Cameron and Jay Cox. It's about Lenny Nero, who is played by Ralph Fiennes, who is a former cop.
I think it's Rafe Fiennes.
It is.
Rafe.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh.
Rafe. Wow.
Yeah. Rafe Fiennes.
This whole my entire life I've been saying his name wrong?
Yeah.
Damn, dude. Sorry. Yeah.
I mean, it's pronounced Ralph, so, you know, it's spelled Ralph.
It is.
It's
oh, my God.
Ralph, so.
I super fucked that up. All right.
Yeah.
I don't know why you let me be the host.
Yeah.
He is a former cop turned VR porn peddler who gets a tape that shows a murder and then hijinks ensues.
Wacky hijinks ensue. Just a comedy cavalcade.
Yeah. Also importantly, Angela Bassett's amazingness is basically wasted by having her make googly eyes at Nero the whole movie. We will talk about that.
Okay.
The next film we subjected ourselves to, again, because we've all seen this at least once before.
It was my first time. It was my first time.
Caro has never seen Hackers, which is also strangely.
Oh!
Whoa, really?
It Ayo. Was.
Man, you should have listened to me when I said we should have talked about The Net and not Hackers.
Yeah, you were right. I will say this, and I want you to feel free to have Phil clip me saying you were right and play it over and over again to help yourself fall asleep at night. You were right. You were right. Right.
I'm into it. All right, let me set this up and then we can be shocked about this revelation. Hackers is also strangely from 1995. It's directed by, I'm assuming Ian, but I could be saying this wrong, softly. And it's about a child prodigy hacker who, along with his ragtag group of weirdos when he gets older, I'm so bad at this, are framed for a major hack into, like, the hardest to get into computer system. Also, Angelina Jolie is in this, and she has the opposite of googly eyes. I think she has pouty face. Mm. You know, women aren't the best in these movies.
Sure.
Anyways, okay, Strange Days and Hackers.
Yeah.
Both of you have never seen Hackers?
No.
No, I
haven't
seen it.
How did this not come out? So we actually had an extensive conversation about what movies we were going to watch, and it was never brought up that they had... Have you seen Strange Days?
Many, many times.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I deliberately voted for Hackers because I hadn't seen it, and because I had this image in my mind that it was this very slick, cool film.
Oh God, no.
So I was like, yeah, well, I was... super duper wrong, but I was like, yeah, you know what? I don't know why I've never seen this. I can't wait to be, you know, just like airdropped back into 90s, you know, hacker aesthetic culture. Like, let me razor cut my hair and, you know, put on a choker necklace and just get into it. And within 30 seconds, I knew I had made a very, very deep mistake.
I mean, I don't regret. I think it's not a good film at all, but I don't regret watching it because I do think it is an interesting sort of cultural touchstone, and of the moment in which it was released. Like, there's a. I want to quote briefly from there's a hacker manifesto that is quoted briefly in the film, and I'm going to read what they read because I think it speaks to like a kind of 90s, like early internet hopefulness about the net as a potential kind of utopia for like justice and like, you know, the for individuals kind of rising up against like oppressive corporations and governments and things like that. One of the sort of anti-hacker cops in the film reads quotes from the manifesto. Hackers saying, "This is our world now, the world of the electron and the switch, the beauty of the bod. We exist without nationality, skin color, or religious bias." Notice no mention of gender. "You wage wars, murder, cheat, lie to us, and try to make us believe it's for our own good, yet we're the criminals." And then, like, one of the cops says, "Yeah, that's cool." And the other one says, "It's not cool, it's commie bullshit."
So this is really interesting because as I was watching both of these movies, I kept thinking about like when they were from and the tension of the sort of fear mongering, right? The fear of the internet. And I actually sort of just Googled and I found an article that the title says 1995 marked the birth of internet paranoia films. And I was like, oh my God, yes, that's exactly what I was thinking as I was watching this. And weirdly enough, in 1995, the net hackers, Johnny Mnemonic and Strange Days and GoldenEye and Virtuosity all came out.
Wow, Virtuosity.
Yeah, like they all came out in the same year. So not only like, basically, yeah. My instinct was right here in terms of like because the internet was still kind. It was not new, but it was getting more widespread adoption in homes, and so you got a lot of like the parental fear of their kids getting online, people not really knowing what it's about, and Hollywood has this habit of tapping into those fears. So if you look at like post 9/11 films, there's a lot of like sort of like fears and fear mongering against Arabs, right?
Yeah,
and Muslims,
and just paranoia around even. In Steven Spielberg's War of the Worlds, there's this moment where when the aliens like first arrive and start attacking, little Dakota Fanning, I think, like as they're speeding away, like looks out the back of the car and says, like, "Is it the terrorists?" You know, and there's like American flags on all the homes. So like a lot of films were responding to this post 9/11 angst. But yeah, in the mid 90s, I guess there was like, oh, you know, tapping into particularly that like teen or like early, the fascination that. And the impact that the emerging internet was having on the lives of like young people.
Yeah, and with Strange Days, interestingly, like you don't really, correct me if I'm wrong, but you don't really see tech and technological advancement in the world of 1999 at the time, other than these VR headsets.
Right.
And so the only thing is this sort of like, you know, they're basically you can be anything in them, right? So the idea of the headsets in Strange Days is that you put this weird webby squid thing on your head and you can then you feel the experiences of what you're watching. So if it's someone skydiving or surfing or whatever, but
robbing a convenience store.
Exactly. And a lot of it is porn.
Right.
And the film deals specifically with like snuff porn.
Yeah.
And that's where you go in it. But I was like, but there's no other tech. There's only shitty tech. And Angela Bassett's character is the character that embodies that like anti-tech Luddite kind of like, this is all bad. And we didn't ever see anything that wasn't underground and sort of shitty.
Yeah. So let me say, so Strange Days was a film that was, you know, around the time that it came out, I was like a sophomore in college, and I loved this movie. I loved it so much that like I would have said, like, and a lot of people really didn't like it even then. Like a lot of people just reacted, like just bounced off of it hard. And like I was such a obnoxious fan of the film that my attitude would have been like, oh well, you just don't get it. Like
sure.
I like, because to me, like the image of like, so it, you know, it ends with. It ends like right as 2000, you know, New Year's midnight, you know, New Year's 1999 into 2000. And like Ralph Fiennes and Angela Bassett, you know, share this kiss. And it's like this. I just found that image like so hopeful and like poetic and like deeply like moving. And now when I, you know, obviously like now I think back on the film and, there's a lot of issues with it. There's a lot of issues with it. And yet I still can't help but admire something about like its boldness, like its willingness to kind of just be like to create this kind of like turn of the millennium Fable.
Yeah. So I watched it inappropriately young.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, for some reason, so my sister's 10 years older than me. I remember her and her friends talking about how these two movies they needed to watch was Strange Days and A Clockwork Orange.
Ooh.
So I went and watched both of those movies.
like you assigned yourself homework because you were like, I got to be ready to talk about this, you know, if I'm ever called up to hang out with my big sister.
I did not finish watching A Clockwork Orange for reasons that are probably obvious. I was way too young to be watching this show.
How did you get access to these things?
Honestly, the amount of things I had access to as a child that I shouldn't have, I have no idea. But I think it had to do with immigrant parents who don't know what's what in the world. But wow. I have very fond memories of Strange Days. Like, I remember being very sucked in with the aesthetic. I remember, like, just being so in Angela Bassett is so fucking cool.
Oh, my God.
I had the biggest crush on Juliette Lewis for a long time. So that, like, her stupid-ass songs I thought were the coolest thing ever. And I rewatched it. I think I hadn't seen it until I rewatched it this week. It's fucking horrifying.
Yeah,
I did not realize, one, I didn't realize the amount of violence against women and the graphicness of it.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize it was a story about police brutality. Like, I didn't remember any of that. So watching it felt like watching it again for the first time, almost.
You know that saying, the past is a different country, they do things differently there? It was so weird watching both of these films this weekend and just feeling completely unable to access the part of my brain that would have and did eat up these kind of narratives back in the 90s. Because like Caro, I was a huge Strange Days fan when this movie came out. I know I saw it a couple of times in the theater and have seen it, you know, since then. Not recently, but had seen it, you know, since 95 several times. And yet watching it again this time, I just thought, I don't know that I can even understand who I was back then and what I loved about it. I'm not going to lie. Juliette Lewis's music, I still loved it. There was a part of me that was convinced this was the way forward for music, you know? Like hot, you know, girl singer and like a heavy guitar. Like I still get off on that shit, you know? No shame. But I'm watching it and I'm thinking, I used to be so invested in the relationship between Lenny and Macy. And Macy, if you don't kick this fool the fuck out of your limo, I don't know.
How weird is it to watch them now and be like rooting against them and being like, why the fuck does Angela Bassett like this fool? Like, but at the time, you're like, oh, no, you want, like, she's a good influence. And
yeah,
blah, blah, blah.
You know, she knows that he has the capacity to be better, right? And and she's in love with that, the idea of him as that better person that he has the capacity to be.
That he used to be. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and yeah, because the flashback where she's wearing that crumazing wig and Macy. But yeah, absolutely. Macy represents, like, you know, for lack of a better term, like his better angels, right? You know, the part of Lenny that has not become sort of, you know, completely morally dissolute in this, you know, neon-tinged underworld in which he now operates. But just as a grown-ass woman, I'm like, Macy, this dude, like, you, girl, do not let this dude any further into your life. He is poison. He is poison.
Yeah,
and no matter what Faith ultimately was responsible for, I was so uncomfortable by the way that Lenny pursues her throughout this movie and refuses to let go. Like, that's not romantic, you know? But at the time I first saw this movie, I was like, that's just mad romantic, yo. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really disturbing, like, I feel like this is a very indicative sign of the times and the shifting. Like, not to say this wouldn't happen today, but I think it would be a lot harder to make this film in this way in 2018, yeah. Right?
I feel like the scene, for me, at least for me in particular, the scene in which we so viscerally experience an act of such brutal violence against a woman through the squid, right? Somebody has recorded a woman just being brutalized, and then Lenny it plays it back and sort of experiences it. I mean, it's just, it's so horrifying.
Well, and also watching that, so, okay, I mean, I'm assuming a lot of our listeners have watched it, but yeah. Like, so the way that it goes down is that the person doing the rape and murder is wearing the squid, so you're watching it through their eyes.
Right.
But then they put one on their victim, so their victim feels what the rapist is feeling. Like, it is so many layers of fucked up, and then you're watching, like, Lenny and others play back this whole experience, and you're watching them struggle with, like, getting off. Because the feelings that are being forced into their body, but their conscious mind is like, this is fucking horrifying.
Yeah.
Like, I think that that's part of why I'm like, this is this paranoia about technology. Mm. But also, like, I think they do a really good job of showing just how, like, the extremes of the tech and how fucking horrible, like, this experience is. Like, there's no part of us that doesn't see that it's horrific.
Absolutely.
But it's still, this is a larger conversation about how we depict violence against women. And it's not about the women. It's about Lenny and his, like, attempt to redeem himself as a, you know, a cop gone bad or whatever.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the film certainly implicates the audience in that way, right? Because we watch it, so we see what happens. But the layers to it, right? So the woman who is being victimized is forced to not only watch her victimization, but to experience the visceral thrill that her attacker is getting from it. And we as audience members are doing the same thing, right? Like, we have been, you know, drawn in to this world. And in this particular moment, we are taking, you know, our filmic joy in watching this scene play out. But in a larger sense too, like this is how violence against women is visually presented to us, you know, as something that we can consume kind of uncritically, something that we can take some sort of enjoyment, you know, for different, you know, meanings of the word enjoyment. But I do think the film, you know, is pretty clear about suggesting, like, having a squid is not necessary. We are always already doing this when it comes to violence against women, you know? And women are forced to consume it.
Yeah.
Mm.
The other thing that you brought up in terms of, like, the other sort of real gendered thing here is the way you were saying that you were bothered by the sort of stalking aspect of Lenny and Juliet's character. Mm-hmm. I forget what her name is.
Faith.
That's right. They do. So this is one of those other fucked up, like, no, 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 yes trope things where he's trying to get her back and she keeps saying no, but the film keeps insinuating that she's in a bad situation and she doesn't want to be there. And if he just keeps pursuing her, he'll uncover it and she'll, like, finally get out. And you see that because she runs away with him because she does want to get out because she's afraid. And so I think that's also a part of this larger, like really awful gender representations of, like, not listening to women when, like, they're like, stop stalking me, you fucking psycho X. Well, is psycho a bad word? Can I say psycho?
I think in this context.
Yeah, okay. I was like, but I don't know if it's like an ableist word.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry. Let me know if it is, people. But so, like, just across the board, all of these women are here, like, sort of perpetuating these tropes and not really being, it's all about Lenny and his relationship to these women. And they're all just a part of his emotional growth and journey.
Yeah.
But in a really fucked up way.
Yeah.
And Strange Days is such a seductive aesthetic. Like, they do Catherine Bigelow is a good director, right? Like, she does a really good job of building this aesthetic, which is so in contrast to Hackers in every single way. And I'm really curious what you both felt about, like, watching these back to back and having never seen Hackers before.
Hackers definitely felt goofy. Like, it felt goofy. I mean, and I think, like, goofy in a self-aware sense. So Fisher Stevens is the main villain in this film, a man who insists ridiculously on being referred to as the plague, like, even in meat, you know, quote unquote meat space. And, like, one of his first lines in the film is a sort of tech security guard at the massive corporation he works for, played by Penn Jillette, of all people, like calls him up on the phone. He's like, we have a problem here. And Fisher Stevens' response, you know, is something like, you hapless techno weenie, which is just like the most ridiculous, like hilarious, kind of goofy hacker thing, you know. And but, you know, this film, too, like its gender politics are so revealingly kind of messed up as well, because it's a space in which, so Angelina Jolie is a like remarkably skilled hacker who goes by the handle of Acid Burn. But the film, like at every step of the way, needs to sort of undercut her skill by just one and show that, oh, she'll never be like quite as good as Crash Override / Zero Cool, you know, the main character. Like from the first thing that happens, one of the first things that happens between them is that Crash Override like beats her high score at a video game.
Can we talk about this skate park / arcade spot that they have in? Because like I kind of wish that existed.
For totally.
Like, I don't know why.
Where all the 13-year-olds are smoking and eating fries.
Wow.
No,
that's so good.
This movie, it felt to me like something that, it felt like a bunch of 47-year-olds had written this script and they were like, this is how kids talk, right? You know, like the product of a couple of divorced dads who haven't seen their kids in months. And they were like, oh, yeah, you know, Chad is constantly telling me about these video games he plays. This is great. You know, this is how kids behave these days. You know, again, Steve Buscemi, how are we doing, fellow kids? Yeah, oh, my God.
I just think it's a failure as a piece of engaging storytelling in the sense that it builds up to a climax that... So the big climax is like Fisher Stevens on one end, like tapping a bunch of buttons on a keyboard at the corporation versus the four whatever lead hacker kids tapping a bunch of keys on their keyboards, you know, to prevent this virus from like capsizing these ships and whatever. And they cannot even create like a visual interface for this conflict that makes like compelling sense. So we as viewers don't really understand at any point like what anyone is actually really doing and what the state, you know, it's all this ridiculous stuff like, oh, you know, one of the young hackers puts like a rabbit in the data and we see this rabbit like replicating and stuff.
Yeah.
And then there's like this Pac-Man figure that's like gobbling up the data, but it's all just like meaningless because the film has in no way like established what's actually happening.
And that the aesthetic of hacking in this is so terrible.
So terrible.
It's so like, here's the thing about film, like once film and television started to talk about like tech, it was actually a big struggle. And that's why there's like these ongoing jokes about like zoom in or like, you know, like.
Yeah. Zoom and enhance.
Yeah. Zoom and enhance. Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah. Where you're like, because you need to make it visual so that it's interesting. But like programming is not an interesting visual thing. And so these are the early days of filmmakers trying to figure out how to do it. And the like the pillars of code in the like the big corporate like terminal. Right. And they kept throwing out words like terminal and kernel and all the shit, which are real things. But they just it didn't mean anything like what Ebony was saying.
Yeah. It's fascinating that stuff can work like on the page. If when you read, say, Neuromancer, like, you know, William Gibson's like landmark cyberpunk novel, and he's able to describe cyberspace or the Matrix as these like columns of light and data and it's stuff like he can convey it as like beautiful and kind of spiritual almost. Because it's a place where, you know, you're not attached to your body and it's just this realm but of data. But we've never been able to create that cinematically in a way that's actually works.
I think that the way that people talk about tech in film and television only works when they are talking about human stories and not about the tech.
Absolutely.
So like Halt and Catch Fire is a perfect example where it's never cheesy and you're actually seeing a lot of tech stuff.
Yeah.
But it's all about the character, so it doesn't matter if they're sitting there programming or not, right?
Yeah.
But this does bring up a question because four years later, The Matrix comes out.
Yeah.
And The Matrix is like widely heralded as like the epic You know, like...
Like oh, finally, a legitimately good kind of cyberpunk...
Yeah, and the, like, green and black code is apparently the thing. That's
I mean, it works. It looks... It actually looks cool instead of looking goofy.
Yeah. But
and
everything
it still
in this
good.
Isn't. Yeah.
Yeah. It's clean, right? It looks clean. There's... In this film, there's a hilarious... In my mind, and with the perspective of time, you know, 20 years on, like, there's a hilarious kind of... sequence where Johnny Lee Miller's character is just like hacking for like, you know, 2 days straight or something, and it's basically like his face just with all these like formulas and stuff like flying and floating around it. And I tweeted like photos from it, and I was, you know, my thing was like, oh, that feeling when you're hacking the net. And and somebody very accurately was like, oh, you know, this is Elementary was more like Sherlock, you know, because on Sherlock, you know how he goes into his like mind palace. It was a lot like that.
That's
like,
really
if we'd see that on Elementary, if Johnny Lee Miller entered his like mind palace.
One of the reasons I was so excited to watch this is because of Johnny Lee Miller, who I'm a huge fan of because of Elementary. And I've talked about this before. He is one of the most expressive actors I've ever enjoyed watching, but it was so interesting to see a younger version of him because it was pretty quickly apparent to me that he needs the canvas of an older man's face for that to work for me. You know, like I just, there's something about the way that he has matured as an actor. If you were to tell me that Johnny Lee Miller was going to be in a film today about, you know, technology and the dissolution of the social order or whatever, I would be so into it. And speaking of casting, if I were to tell people who have not seen Hackers that the cast includes people like Wendell Pierce.
Seriously,
Felicity
bunk.
Huffman. Yeah. Lorraine Bracco.
Yeah.
Mark Anthony. Penn Jillette. And right? Fisher Stevens. Would you ever in a million years think, oh yeah, that cast, that's gotta be about the net. You know? That's gotta be about the internet. Lorraine Bracco, I am not entirely convinced she knew what movie she was in. She was so befuddled throughout this whole thing. And I want someone to clip for me the scene where she's just going, cancer, brain cancer.
I know.
Brain. So watching her, I kept being like, were the direction to be over the top and ridiculous?
Because they had to have been, right?
I was
they
like,
had to
are
been.
You that terrible? You're not that terrible of an actor. Like how,
no.
Like that was so excessive. Like she was like five steps excessively worse than almost everybody in it in terms of that particular
except
type
for
of
like the FBI agents, right? Like the other hilariously over the top thing was the FBI agents trying to like blend in with the youths, you know, at the parties or at the park or whatever, and just the completely uncool way they did it seemed to be very self-conscious. I could not put my finger on what this movie was doing. I honestly, like, tonally, it felt all over the place, and I couldn't tell if it was kind of, you know, winking and nudging into the campy territory or if it was just that incompetent at times. But I do have to say, I am very grateful for this movie for presenting Angelina Jolie to me as a Vulcan, because she looked so much like she should have been in Starfleet that I was like, yo, I didn't know I needed Angelina Jolie as a Vulcan, but now I know.
So knowing now that Johnny Lee Miller and Angelina Jolie got married after this movie, I was watching the movie being like, oh, there's got to be like intense chemistry between them. Nothing.
No.
There's no chemistry between them. I think their marriage lasted like 6 months or some shit like that.
I don't know. This is a conversation maybe for another time. But this movie forced a lot of emotions out of me. But I was like, you know what? I really enjoyed Angelina Jolie and Gia the way that a lot of people did. But yeah, I don't think she's a good actor.
We should have a bigger conversation about that.
Let's do. Because I really want to unpack.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said, you know, she was young in this. So if I'm, you know, cutting Johnny Lee Miller a break, I got to cut Angelina a break, too. But I haven't seen similar growth from her in her, you know, most recent work. So
I really quickly want to mention the queer the stuff around queer issues in Hackers. So like there's one scene where the hacker known as the Phantom Freak is like being escorted past all these like inmates in prison, and they're all like reaching out to him and like pawing him and clawing him, and it's really like scary, and it's obviously like meant to make us uncomfortable, like, oh, he's, you know, what's going to happen to him in jail, and also like it weirdly positions him as like this kind of pretty, you know, feminine kind of figure. And then but then there's also these two like Asian hackers,
yeah,
who end up being kind of important in the story, who are super queer coded. I mean, yeah,
there's also the trans joke, the anti-trans joke.
Yeah, I mean, this, yeah, oh boy, that's,
well, then at the very beginning when fucking Johnny Lee Miller, whatever his character's name is with his mom, and she asks like, you like girls.
Oh, you like girls, don't you? Yeah.
Yeah. And then he, you know, slams into the bathroom. And then one of the weirdest line readings is like, yeah, and I'm still a virgin.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it was like, I don't know if that was meant to be like, you know, yeah, and I'm still a virgin and I hate it. You know, like I'm kind of a horny youth, or, you know, no, like, of course, a bad kid like me would constantly be out, you know, banging my fellow high school students, whatever. I don't know.
It was super
just
weird.
A weird, weird movie.
I have one final question before we move on.
Mm-hmm.
Are you ready for this question?
Is it about how to pronounce Ralph Fiennes?
I did. You know what? I did know that. And as you said it, and I've been thinking about it, I was like, I did know that, but I read it because I read. Yeah. I feel like,
girl,
it's
cool.
About it.
You
it's
should
fine.
Hang out with my dad. My dad still calls him Ralph Fiennes.
Your dad's amazing. All right. All right. My question. Do you think that Johnny Lee Miller, our favorite Sherlock, ever, mm-hmm, learned how to rollerblade for the part, or
girl,
was already a rollerblading pro?
Wow.
The rollerblade escape in this movie gave me everything I needed to get through the rest of that Saturday. I was like, I forgot how big rollerblading was, you know? Like,
yeah.
People, yeah, thought that shit was the wave.
No moment in this film gave me more joy than the moment where Fisher Stevens and Johnny Lee Miller arranged to like swap a disc or exchange a disc. And so Johnny Lee Miller's like on the street holding out the disc, and along comes Fisher Stevens like on a skateboard, like holding on to the corporate limo or whatever. And he like speeds by Johnny Lee Miller, grabs the disc, and then they just roll on and like vanish into this cloud of New York City steam. Oh, it's beautiful. It's so beautiful.
So good.
Okay, let's move on to
What's Your Freak Out?
Ebony.
Yes.
What's your freak out this week?
Oh, boy. I apologize in advance to all three of our listeners and to my two lovely co-hosts. My freak out this week is Tom Cruise.
Okay. Please go on.
And you know what? We may need to have... Okay, so let's have an Angelina Jolie conversation in a future episode. Let's also talk about Tom Cruise, because there is something so phenomenologically, like, interesting about Tom Cruise, the actor, you know, like, the blockbuster actor, but also Tom Cruise, the person, and the way our understanding of both gets folded into... Whatever. So y'all know I am a hardcore fan of the action grandpa genre. Doesn't matter if it's Liam Neeson.
Do we know
Denzel
that?
Washington. Well,
I knew it because it's come up on Cinema Ball.
Okay.
Yeah. So
it's like
newsflash to everybody. Big fan of the action gramps genre, because I think there's something so interesting about the specter of an older man kind of refusing to acquiesce physically to younger men, you know, like literally, but also symbolically. Like, I'm fascinated by this, right? So I'm very interested in Tom Cruise and the way that he is approaching his entries into the action gramps genre via like Mission Impossible. Obviously, like, that's the huge one, but also the Jack Reacher movies. So I have not read any of the Jack Reacher novels, but they are incredibly successful. I think there's like 20 of them shits now. And it's about this guy who is a physical giant, like 7 feet tall and just like built like a refrigerator. And he's this nomad who travels the country. He doesn't own anything. He literally wears his clothes until they, you know, are like fall off, and then, you know, buys news and, you know, just has like no trail. And he's former military intelligence, and you can write the rest of the story from there, right? And so, you know, goes around the country essentially being like a vigilante and occasionally getting called in like Rambo to straighten out like, you know, like drug cartels or whatever, right? So this very popular series of books, Tom Cruise buys the rights and decides to play the main character. Now, again, Jack Reacher in the books is a physical giant. Tom Cruise, the older he gets, is like, yep, yeah, you know what role I want to play? Jack Reacher. I want to know what's going on mentally as he kind of processes his aging and his still, like, you know, one of the things we talk about when a new Tom Cruise film comes out is like how he does his own stunts and, you know, how he's very, like physically still very kind of dominant, right? But there's just something so interesting going on. So anyways, I'm watching the last Jack Reacher movie, like a week ago, and I was just struck by how, compared to Mission Impossible, for instance, you can really see the way that Tom wears his age. It's not as slick. It's not as polished as the Mission Impossible movies, as you would expect. It doesn't have nearly the budget, right? But we got to talk about the very like sort of 20th century version of this and how it stands in, you know, comparison to the way this used to come about in like Westerns or whatever, where you also had older men, you know, fighting for law and order and truth and justice and whatever. But there wasn't this sort of insistence upon them, you know, carrying their bodies in the way that like Liam Neeson and Tom Cruise have to do it. I don't know. I'm freaking out, you guys. I want to talk about this. Hit me up on Twitter. I can't stop thinking about it.
All right.
All right.
What are they? Jack Reacher, keep on reaching. Jack Reacher, reach yes. harder.
Wait, is that real? Or are those
Jack Reacher to Jack to reach?
Yeah. No, I'm making good. Those up, but yeah. I have. It blows my mind that they even made a second one of those movies. Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't even know that movie exists.
Yeah, what's your freak out?
All right, my freak out is I've been playing a bunch of a game called Shadowrun Dragonfall, which is a cyberpunk RPG. It was put out by Harebrained Schemes. I've been streaming it on our Twitch channel. And, you know, given that we've been talking about cyberpunk stuff, like, so the combat in Harebrained Schemes cyber Shadowrun games is kind of like XCOM-y, you know, you it's turn-based, you take cover, there's like percentages of your likelihood to hit with your attacks and all that stuff. And I don't love that kind of combat, but everything around that stuff in the game is really excellent in terms of the world building, the writing, the characterizations, and, you know, in particular, these games and, you know, Dragonfall, especially thus far, is so great about having a range of, you know, female characters who break the traditional mold of the roles that female characters traditionally fill in games. They're not by any means sort of sexualized or kind of nudged into these kind of pre-existing molds. Like, you really have a wide range of characterizations, and the game is so explicit in its sort of anti-fascist like politics to you know, obviously set contextualized in this future world where, you know, you have like trolls and elves and orcs and things, and so like they're the ones being persecuted, but the game makes no bones about creating those direct connections between like persecution of them and like actual fascist kind of ideologies. I think it's extremely, you know, it's well done for that kind of thing, and it's just a really gripping narrative. It's again, like the characterizations, the writing is so strong that it really pulls you into that world and that story. And yeah, so the game came out a few years ago. I'm only really getting around to it now, but you know, in keeping with the theme, this is our cyberpunk theme. If you are at all interested in cyberpunk genre and, you know, you play role-playing games, definitely check out Shadowrun Dragonfall if you get a chance.
Cool.
Yeah.
I'm freaking out about capitalism.
So rad.
This will be quick.
Yeah. Done.
Yeah.
Specifically in relation to libraries. So libraries are deeply anti-capitalist by nature. They're a shock that they even exist anymore. They would not exist today if they were invented today. If someone was like, hey, let's set up in every city several buildings full of books and movies and items that the public can take away for free and then return all the time. That would never happen.
The only way it would happen today is if it was proposed by Elon Musk as some kind of like new visionary idea, and he figured out some way to make like
there's a membership fee.
There's like some exactly. make a ton of money off of it. Yeah.
So I fucking love libraries. I think you should support the hell out of libraries. And you know, Ebony and I used our local public libraries a lot for our upcoming book, History versus Women, which you can pre-order now at historyversuswomen.com. But here's the thing. I've been checking out, quote unquote, a lot of ebooks from the library, which is a cool thing you can do, like, you know, whatever. And I read most of my books on Kindle anyway, so it's nice to have that option. But here's the thing that pisses me off. The way that you can rent ebooks is you go and you look
on it. Borrow.
Yeah, sorry. You look them up on an app, and if the library has 5 copies of book X, then only 5 people can have it checked out at a time.
Yeah.
And if all 5 people have them checked out, you are put on hold, and you put the book on hold as you would a physical book. So the model for ebooks is exactly the same as physical books. When it becomes available, you are then informed that it is available and you can check it out. They are digital fucking books.
Yeah.
There are no limitations to how many copies can be released at a time. So the fact, I think, and I meant to look this up. Someone told me this many years ago, so I don't know if it's different. But I believe what I was told, which I love that I'm spreading fucking rumors right now, is that publishers insist that ebooks be treated like physical books and that they can only be checked out a certain amount of times before the book actually physically falls apart and can't be checked out anymore. And so they're treating it the same way. And this shit pisses me off because it's an issue of access and finances, right? Libraries have to pay for these licenses. Fuck that shit. I'm freaking out against capitalism. Like, we should be able to check out all of the ebooks. Everyone should have access to them all the time. And it's just, it makes me really upset.
I've been on the waiting list for 50 Shades Darker for so long now.
Let me just slip you my copy, Caro.
Okay. Thanks, Ebony.
All right, y'all. You can submit your own freak out if you got something on your mind at feministfrequency.com/freakout. That's FREQOUT. And that's our show. So you can catch us back here every single Wednesday. And remember that we would love it if you joined our podcast community and help us bring this delightful show to you every week at d.rip/femfreak. Hey, Carolyn.
Hey.
If people are enjoying the show, what should they do?
They should hack the planet so that every website on the planet simultaneously starts flashing the words, you know, femfreak, d.rip/femfreak.
Can it not be that? Can it be? No, we like that. We like that. We don't hate that URL at all. It's not the worst URL that's ever existed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, cool. But you can also, we'd love it if you would rate and review us on iTunes because that helps.
Yeah, if you want to take the easy path, I mean, there's that too.
But either way,
yeah,
whichever
one. It's very helpful and very appreciated.
Also, while you are on your rollerblades hacking the net at the same time, tell your friends about Feminist Frequency Radio and that they might be interested. You can check out all of our work and our other podcasts at feministfrequency.com, and you can follow us on Twitter at FemFreak to stay up to date on all of the news. You can also find each of us on Twitter, which we will read every single tweet you send us. Psych. No, we won't. I'm at Anita Sarkeesian.
I'm at Carolyn Michelle.
I am at brain cancer, cancer, brain, brain cancer.
Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music, technical support by Sarah Norales, and art by Jamie Varon. We'll see you all next week.
Later.
Bye. You were right.